Okay, I know that a lot of you have been waiting patiently to be able to throw Daniel into the lion's den, so we're going to toss him to the lions today. You finally get your wish, though I don't know why you've been looking forward to that. Too much violence on TV or something, but but hopefully, I know that's the most popular, that's the reason the story's most popular. Everybody knows about Daniel in the lion's den, but hopefully as we've gone through chapter 6, you've seen why there's a lot of important stuff going on besides just having lions. And so I hope you're enjoying that, but we're going to finally toss Daniel in with the lions. And chapter 5 was the end of the Babylonian kingdom. We talked plenty about Babylon, and when God condemned Belshazzar, if you remember in the handwriting on the wall, and he told him that he was weighed and found wanting and that his kingdom would be divided. And those were what the words meant, that he was weighed and wanting and his kingdom was divided. And interestingly enough, not only is it a division as in, you know, in the statue, the giant statue that Nebuchadnezzar's dream, there's the golden head, and then there was the silver chest and arms. And we talked about how that represented the Medes and the Persians. And so there was not only that division between the Medes and the Persians, how it's now it's a divided kingdom because there's these two separate kingdoms that have come together, but then also, at the very beginning of chapter 6 tells us how King Darius, the Mede, is dividing up the kingdom into 120 different provinces. So I just think that's an interesting transition from chapter 5 ends with your kingdom is divided, and Belshazzar died that night, and his kingdom literally was divided by the Medes and the Persians. But then also, chapter 6 starts right up saying, this is how it got divided, 120 separate provinces with 120 princes and then three high government officials over those 120 princes. And it goes through this the new system of government that it tells us about with those lower leaders and then the higher leaders and then finally the king. And as you might expect, whenever the government gets bigger, the things become less efficient and more problematic because you've got more people who want a piece of the action. And so to solve the new problems of bigger government, what King Darius did is he just added more government, right? That's the solution. And so you get more minds in there. But it seems like things always become more. There's more bureaucratic red tape. And there's all just, you know, the more people you have up the system, the more managers you have, it seems like the more problems you run into. And so to King Darius assigned on top of these 120 princes three presidents or high administrators to manage all those other officials to kind of keep track of what they were doing. And as grace would have it, Daniel happened to be one of those three presidents. And I say grace because that was God's work, making sure that he was in there. God has been working in Daniel's life to put him in a position to have influence over kings and leaders and lots of people. And so Daniel happened to be one of those three leaders, and wouldn't you know it, the king noticed that Daniel had an excellent spirit. He watched him, and he saw that he was a man of integrity and was a hard worker and got the job done. He brought in the money that the other two presidents weren't bringing in, that somehow these provinces were losing money. And so the king assigned the three presidents in order to try to solve that problem of losing money. And apparently Daniel was the one who was doing the best job of that. But it tells us that the reason he liked him, the reason he wanted to set Daniel above even those presidents, was because he had an excellent spirit. And the king noticed that, and so he was going to put Daniel to manage the other officials. And of course, we knew all this time that God was alive in Daniel's life. We've seen Daniel from the time he was a kid and taken into Babylon, and we've read the first five chapters and seen basically his a long life of service to God. But to Darius, Daniel is just a breath of fresh air because he's got these 120 leaders that are losing his money, and then he assigns the three presidents, and there's still something missing except for Daniel. And he's this new experience for the king, a government official that is actually honest and does his job well. And so Daniel brightens the king's day, and he respects the people that he works for, and he does he helps to get things working the way they ought to be so that the king stops losing money in his 120 provinces. And of course, anybody with any sense knows that if you really want to fix problems in your government, in any government, you hire Christians who, because of their true faith and their honest and they're incorruptible. I mean, a real Christian, that's the way they should be. So if you hire a real faithful Christian, then when they take on a job, they work as unto the Lord. Because a lot of other people, they work as unto themselves. But when you hire a Christian, a true Christian, a believer, then they work as unto the Lord. So whatever job they're in, whether they're picking up trash or whether they're the President of the United States, they work as unto God, and therefore they do a good job, and they're committed, and they're upright, and you can't corrupt them with the things that so many government officials get corrupted by. And so Daniel was a believer. Obviously, this is before Jesus was born, so we couldn't call him a Christian, but he was dedicated to God, and his life showed it. And so with that, along with the integrity that a believer brings to the job and the forthrightness and an excellent spirit that Daniel had, he also brings with him, because of his faithfulness, the blessings of God. He comes into, so anybody that has a chance to hire a believer ought to do it, because a true believer who's dedicated to the Lord is going to bring the blessings of the Lord with him into that position. And whatever job they have, because they work as unto the Lord. That's the way we're supposed to do. So Darius planned to put Daniel in charge of every other official because he found somebody who was just like that. And of course, all the other officials hated the idea because we've talked about before how they were going to miss out on their extra profits. And so they worked together to get God out of government. That's what they wanted to do, was to get this man who represented the God of the Israelites out of the system. And so, like King Darius, they wanted to be gods of their own little world. Remember, King Darius decided to write a law to make him god for a month. And these other guys, basically, they wanted to be their own gods. So they conspired together to kill Daniel, and they wrote this new law that said that people can worship Darius, but they can't worship anything else. If anybody's going to bow, you got to bow to the king, and you got to worship the king for a month. And the reason they did that was because they all knew that Daniel was so faithful to God that he would never worship anybody else. He would never bow to anybody but the Lord. And so they tricked the king into signing this law because he was so full of himself. He was too full of himself, and so he didn't realize their plot. He just thought, oh, what a great opportunity for me to shine. And so when Daniel ignores this new law and goes home and gets on his knees in front of his open windows towards Jerusalem like he's always done, of course they catch him and they see what he's doing. He's probably like clockwork, doing it at the same time every day, three times a day. And so they spring their trap, and they go and they report him to the king, who has no choice but to sentence Daniel to death. And that's where we left our hero last week. He's been sentenced to death, hanging in the balance, and under the weight of some very bad judgment, of course, because the king had stupidly agreed to put his seal on this new law, declaring himself God for a month. And when he did that, he unknowingly condemned his favorite public servant and probably his friend to death by lions. And gruesome. But ironically, the thing that happened with King Darius is a pretty common problem in our world today, and you've probably dealt with it yourself, and no doubt you've fallen into this trap in your lifetime. I would venture to say that probably just about everybody here. And if you are still falling for it, then I hope we can teach you a way to spot this trap and avoid it, and not fall for the bait like King Darius did. Of course, I'm not talking about people getting eaten by lions, but people who want to be God. That's a big problem that continues on in our world today. People who want to be God. They want to be their own God. They'd probably like to be other people's gods. But that's probably the number one problem in our world today. People who want to usurp the throne of God. People who don't want to submit to God. They don't want to do what God tells us to do. But they would rather consider themselves the rulers of their own life. That I do what I want to do, and it doesn't matter what God says. Now it's true that we have free will. that God has given us the ability to choose what we want, to decide what we put our faith in, and which direction we go, and what to do with our own bodies. We've been given that freedom. But the simple truth is about these bodies that we have, that, and the freedom that we have in them, is that they're on loan from God. We don't own it. It's a part-time temporary thing we've been given. And it's a temporary setup. You could think of this, you know, we call our body our temple. You could think of it more as a mobile home. You know, you get to travel around for a little while, and eventually you're going to have to give it up, and it's a mobile home for your spirit. And so the choices we make in these temporary housings, though, affect us eternally. The choices that we make in this life, in these bodies, with these minds that we've been given freedom to choose, they affect our destiny. They change our future, and they affect us eternally, depending on the choices that we make. So because God has made us, and he's made our universe, and he's made the planets and the animals and the stars and everything, God has made everything according to his goodness. When he created the world, when he created the universe, and he created life, he did it according to his goodness, to his righteousness. And so if we choose to depart from that kind of a life, if we choose to say, you know what, I don't want God's goodness, I'm going to go my own direction, I'm going to be my own God, God has prescribed for us a life of righteousness. He says, this is the way you should live. This is the way you're required to live. And if we depart from that, then we depart from God. And so, by natural logic, it means that we must be separated from God eternally. If we choose to depart from him and say, we don't want anything to do with you, then there comes a point when God says, okay, that's your final decision, then you're separate. If you want your own way, then you're going to be cut off from God, and you're going to be cut off from all the good things, which is anything good comes from God. So you're cut off from all good things that he's made. And so the side effect of sin is death. And when we infect ourselves with that death by choosing unrighteousness, we become a cancer. When we choose evil, and evil spreads, when we perpetrate it on other people and perpetrate it against God, that we become a cancer that can spread evil to others. When people watch our behavior and they copy what we do, and our children see what we do, and society sees what we do. And so, like any good doctor, God must remove that cancer in order to allow the healthy part of the body to continue to grow. And so that's why some of those judgments that you read about in the Bible, sometimes they seem pretty harsh. I've heard lots of people ask me questions like, how can God allow a whole city to be destroyed like that? Sometimes we read that and we think, man, that just seems really severe. But in truth, when God does that, it's a last-ditch effort to preserve the lives of others, because it's a cancer. Sin and evil, it's a wicked mess. And if, of course, we choose it, but if we choose not to change, then God has to get rid of it. If we don't choose God, if we don't repent, if we don't follow Christ, then God has to cut that out and say, I can't have this in the healthy part of my body. And so, if you've ever dealt with cancer, you know, real physical cancer in your body, or if you know somebody who's dealt with it, you know that sometimes the treatment can be pretty severe, can be very painful, can cause a lot of side effects and problems. And as harsh as it may seem to judge whole cities and whole nations, have no doubt that it hurts God deeply to lose anybody, to lose a single life to sin and death. It hurts God when he has to remove that. And to remove a whole city is even worse. To remove a whole nation, to remove a whole world, when God flooded the earth in Noah's time, God is sorely hurt when that happens, when he's forced to cut that out. It's a grievous thing for his heart. But he does it with good intentions. He does it, you know, he created us for good. He created us to be righteous, to make the world a better place, to improve the planet that he put us on, to improve the world by helping people to become better people. And so he created it for good, but then we choose to mutate it into something evil. And so this mutation of wickedness that we cause by choosing sin, when God has to remove the influence of evil through judgment, it's meant to benefit those who are willing to live for God. It's meant to benefit those who say, we want a good world, we want a better world, we want to live righteous lives and encourage others to live righteous lives. And so God protects those people and gives them their blessing. And so when he judges, he removes the wickedness from what he can preserve. And so the point is that you may think that you can be God for a month or for a year or for a lifetime, but if you really do, you're deceiving yourself. And I'm not talking about an official declaration like Darius did. I'm talking about when you say, you know what, I can do better than what God has for me. I want to stick to my evil habits that I've gotten used to. I want to keep doing the things that I know I shouldn't do because I'm smarter than God and I'm better than God. That's really what you're saying. When you choose to live life your way, when you know it's wrong, that's saying that you're God because you don't want to listen to God. There's only one true God, and he does not share his rule. And so if you want to have any hope of the future, really the only way to find it is by turning to God, by turning the one who gave us life in the first place and obeying him as king. Jesus Christ is the King of Kings and the Lord of Lords. And if you think you're going to get away with doing life your own way apart from God, think again, because there comes a judgment. There comes a reckoning. Even King Darius realized, he came to realize at least, that his power was limited. That, yeah, he could say he's God, but he can't do everything that God can do. And just by signing a decree that everybody had to worship him doesn't make him God. And in fact, it doomed his friend Daniel to death because Daniel wouldn't worship Darius. Daniel wouldn't worship anybody but the one true God. And so when Darius realized his powerlessness in that situation, and he pored over his legal books and everything, all the laws that he could find to see if there's some loophole to get Daniel out, and he realized there was nothing he could do. He's going to have to put his friend to death. Even he had to turn to God for help. Now, I don't think he really became a believer at this point, but he was just so desperate and realized there's nothing he could do. He said, Daniel, I pray that the God that you serve, that you're so faithful to, will save you. And so in your own temptations, in the things that you deal with when sin comes knocking, it's not a battle of should I do something good or should I do something bad. It's a battle of who you worship and who you trust in, who you truly believe, where your faith is. Do you trust in God? If you really truly trust in God, then you will submit to whatever he tells you to do. If your faith is in God, then when he says do this, you do it. When he says don't do this, you don't do it. I mean, it's that simple. It's who do you believe in? Who do you worship? Where's your trust? If you don't trust in God, then you'll choose to submit to that temptation because you believe in the temptation more than you believe in God, even though you know God's told you not to do it. The only reason people do bad things is to make themselves their own God. They choose to do what they know is wrong. And they follow their own rules, pretending that it won't affect their future, pretending that they won't have to pay the price, that there won't be consequences, that it won't affect the people around them, that it won't affect their families, that it won't affect future generations. They pretend that sin is their own little thing and it's not hurting them and it's not hurting anybody else, so why do I have to stop? But when you love God, when you truly love the Lord, your life shows it in obedience to his commands. Because that's what love does. Love does what helps other people. And in treating other people with love. When you believe in God, when you trust in him, then you love him and you do what he tells you to do because you love him. And you love other people and you take care of them the same way you take care of yourself. Ultimately, we all give account for our behavior to the Lord. And there is no way to stand before Jesus Christ on Judgment Day and make excuses for your sin. I've talked to a lot of people who plan on doing that. They plan on getting up there and looking at God and saying, but, you know, this is I'm a special case, God. You know, this is why I should be allowed to sin against you. This is why I should be allowed to do the things that you told me not to do, because I'm a special case. When in truth, they have that idea that they're going to get, you know, make an excuse to God. But really, when they stand before Jesus Christ on Judgment Day, their mouths are going to be shut. and they're going to be on their knees, and the only thing they'll be able to say is, Jesus Christ is Lord. And they're not going to be able to make excuses, because they will finally accept the truth that there is no excuse for sin. And so that's what's going to happen to people that choose to submit to sin and temptation. And so there, all you'll be able to say is, I knew what I did was wrong. I knew it at the time that I was doing it. And I knew I was disobeying you. And I deserve the punishment for my crimes. That's it. Everybody who stands before God with sin in their hearts, that's all they'll be able to say. When the revelation of pure truth is standing before them, all they'll be able to say is, I deserve everything that you have to give me because I sinned against you with full knowledge. And completely ignored the sacrifice that you made for my sins. Completely ignored the opportunity that you gave me to turn around and to live a new life. To completely ignored the chance to repent and obey and to be made in a new creation and to live life by your power. I rejected that and I chose my own way. I wanted to be my own God, and therefore I deserve whatever punishment you have to dish out. And that's the only thing people will be able to say on Judgment Day. So you can try to sit on the throne of your life, but one day, Scripture tells us, every knee shall bow and every tongue confess that Jesus Christ is Lord. So King Darius realized, he got a taste of it, that God is the only one that has the power to help in this situation. God is the only one with any real power in any situation. Even the mighty King Nebuchadnezzar, who was the one king over all this territory, realized that the only power that he had came from God. And that was a good lesson. It was good to see that Nebuchadnezzar had that turnaround in his life, that he realized that God is the one who sets up kings and takes down kings. And if you reject the Lord and try to make your rules for your own life, the ultimate end will be eternal separation from Almighty God. If you choose to go your own way, there comes a point where he says, okay, you're separate, you go your own way, and that's the consequences. So when King Darius realized that he was out of options, he told Daniel that his only hope was in the real God. In verse 16, I'll pick up there in chapter 6, he said, so at last the king gave orders for Daniel to be arrested and thrown into the den of lions. And the king said to him, may your God, whom you serve so faithfully, rescue you. Now, what's crazy about all this is Daniel's not being punished for something that he's done or for something that he's not done. There wasn't a law in the books that said, you know, you got to live this way. They wrote a special law. They had to add something because before this, Daniel was a perfectly good citizen. Did his job well, did what he was supposed to do, lived according to the law. And so it's not like there was a law that all of a sudden he decided to break. They had to add something to make him he was a law-abiding citizen, and the government wrote a new law in order to penalize him for something that he's always done before, completely legally. It's interesting. It sounds kind of similar to some executive orders that were signed into law recently. But I'm telling you, the more that you look into Daniel's life, into this book, the more you'll see our own culture. And so the same things that the government did back then, they do today. And they'll write new laws to punish people if they can. And that's another reason that Daniel is such a great example for us. Because he lived through this. And he modeled the way that we're supposed to behave as Christians. And so when we can look at Daniel and say, then I'm going to do that. That's how I'm going to live my life, just like Daniel. And for his faithfulness and for his love of God and his dedication to the Lord, they tossed the lion-hearted into the lion's den. And now you maybe have seen paintings of this scene, pictures of Daniel in the lion's den. There's been some real nice artwork done on it. And usually they have Daniel standing there serenely, you know, looking up in prayer, and there's a light shining on his head, and he's kind of calm, and he's kind of just standing there. And there's usually about, you know, half a dozen lions surrounding him, looking on in reverence to his prayerfulness. And it's, you know, they're really good pictures, you know, nice artwork sometimes. But I want to paint a new scene for you to picture in your mind's eye. Verse 24 says that when Daniel was survived the lion's den, that the king then threw his accusers and their families into the den of lions. And it tells us that before they even hit the ground, they were already attacked and their bones were crushed by the lions. Like, they didn't even have a chance to hit the ground before they were goners. And if you remember how many people accused Daniel, if verse 7 tells us all the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the high officials and the governors. That's a lot of people and their families. And so we're talking at least 120 provincial princes and the other two administrators that were over them. So at least 122 people and their families. If they averaged three a family, you know, if they each only had one kid, that's 366 people that are tossed into this lion's den. 366 people that get mauled before they even hit the ground. That's a lot of lions. I mean, this is a huge, I mean, it must have been a cavern of some sort where they dropped these people down and it was just this place of hungry lions. Needless to say, you know, I mean, you got a lot of people, a lot of lions, and they're, even if they tossed them in one at a time, you know, there's one opening and they put them in, you still got lions that are chomping down on those guys while new lions come and grab those ones before they can hit the ground. This is a mess. I mean, it's gruesome, terrible, awful mess, but you've got a huge group of hungry lions that are just ready to take whatever victims and newcomers they can get there and grab them in their jaws and chew them up and drag them away. So you've either got a really big hole of some sort or a cavern of some sort where they can drop them in, but it's teeming with hundreds of lions. And I don't know if you've ever been up close to a real lion, like if you've had a chance at the zoo or something. It can be intimidating. You know, one big lion up close. I mean, they usually only let you get within 20 feet, but that's close enough to see the power of a lion. And especially if it's roaring. If you've ever heard a lion roar, it'll shake your bones. And they let out that roar, and it can be pretty scary, even behind the bars of the cage. And so it's I can imagine. I'm sure that I wouldn't want to spend the night where Daniel spent the night. But that's where they threw this 80-plus-year-old guy, or year-young guy, depending on your perspective. But they threw Daniel, this octogenarian, into this pit with hundreds of lions in order to kill him. And Daniel 6:17 says, a stone was brought and placed over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed the stone with his own royal seal, so they probably dripped wax on it, and he had his ring, and he pressed his seal into it, and along with the seals of his nobles, so that nobody could come and rescue Daniel. Nobody could take that stone away and give him a chance to get out. So I'm sure that they probably didn't expect him to survive for more than a few minutes. If this was a big sort of cavernous setup, maybe it, you know, lions were off doing whatever they usually do, and it took him a few minutes to walk in there. But I'm sure they didn't expect him to live for long. He was, and just in case, he was left there overnight to be sure the lions had a chance to eat their dinner or their breakfast. And we don't know exactly how things unfolded in the lion's den that night. It just tells us that he spent the night there. Perhaps God placed a shield around him. You know, the angels surrounding him with their mighty swords, keeping those lions from Daniel to protect him from these ravenous, angry, roaring beasts who would have liked to get him, but they were stopped by the angels. Maybe it was something like that. But I like to imagine that God actually tamed the animals, that he simply took away their hunger for the night, and he tamed them, and so they welcomed Daniel. They were just like, okay, we'll be house cats for the night. And you can walk among us, and you can pet us, and you can lay, you know, so the prophet could curl up on a bed of lions and be kept warm by their body heat as the king of the beasts became his pillow for the night. And so he just nuzzled up with some lions and nice fur coats and said his evening prayers and put his head down and slept like a baby. That's what I like to imagine. It doesn't tell us that in the scripture, but that's what I picture when Daniel's just, you know, he went peacefully to sleep and spent the night in nice, warm comfort. Meanwhile, back at the palace, in verse 18, it says, then the king returned to his palace and spent the night fasting, and he refused his usual entertainment, and he couldn't sleep at all that night. So while Daniel's sleeping like a baby, the king's up and worried and stressed out that his friend's going to die, and realizing that he signed that stupid law, he should have never done that, and now he's got to pay the price by losing his friend and losing the one official who promised to bring prosperity back into his kingdom. And so the king was pretty shaken up over this whole deal. On top of that, he'd been made a fool of by his own officials, but he's forced to sentence his friend to death. And it's his own fault, it's his own vanity that brought about Daniel's demise. And to top it all off, you know, his best financial manager, his best administrator, who could have, you know, hit everything that the king had hoped to improve the kingdom, and now it's gone. And so now he would have to put up with the continued losses that he'd been suffering, which is why he set up these provinces in the first place, and with full knowledge that it was those people, those provincial leaders and those administrators that had tricked him into signing this law, who were robbing him in the first place. He's realizing he's going to have to put up with them now, because there's nobody else that he can think of who has the excellent spirit that Daniel has to help him to run the show. So he's just completely shaken up, and he's stressed out over this whole affair, and it's his own fault. But presumably, the condemned Daniel rested while his condemner, the king, was restless, and the king couldn't eat, it says, and he couldn't sleep, and his usual distractions that helped him to relax. Maybe he had people that played music. Remember when David played music for Saul, or people that danced for him, or whatever. Who knows what kinds of distractions he had, but he said nothing could do it. Nothing could put his mind at ease. Nothing could relax him. He couldn't sleep. He was stressed out. He couldn't eat. And so it seems like the only ones that went hungry that night were King Darius and the lions. And of course, it's kind of hard to feel sorry for King Darius. His own pride is what allowed him to get into this predicament in the first place. And besides that, he's not the one who's facing the lions right now. I mean, he's back in a palace, and he's got all sorts of entertainment that's offered to him, and he's got all sorts of food that's offered to him, even if he can't take it. But oh, how he wished there was a way to keep the law and to preserve order in his kingdom and still be able to keep Daniel from being thrown to his death. He wished that. All day long, he wished that. He wished that there was some way that he could keep Daniel from being eaten and still preserve law in his kingdom. But he couldn't do it, because the law of the Medes and Persians is unchangeable. And once he signed that law as king, not even he could change it. And there was nothing that he could do to change the law. And there was nothing that he could do to save his friend. And if you really think about it, that's basically the dilemma that God faces with us. And God created this world, created this whole universe to be good, to be a place of righteousness that reflected His glory and His righteousness. And people have made a huge mess of God's creation. And they've made themselves into gods in their own hearts, and they go their own way. And just like King Darius, it has wreaked havoc on God's creation. And sin has made a terrible mess of things. And so now the world is filled with death and suffering and people killing each other. And it's all a result of the sinfulness of human beings who refused to obey their Creator, who created them to be good, who created them to be righteous. So what's God to do with us? Because the law says we're to be killed. We're to be separated. We're to be eternally. He still loves us. He created us. He created us for good, and He loves us. And in spite of all our wickedness, God's heart still breaks over each and every one of us who is lost, because He's willing that none should perish, but that all should repent. And so when we've turned our backs on Him, what's He supposed to do? When we've walked away from His love and walked away from His law, how's He supposed to help us? Because His perfect law says we must die for our sins and be cast out of His kingdom. And since we have sinned against an eternally good God, a God of pure love and righteousness, then it's only right that we suffer an eternal punishment for sinning against such a wonderful God. And for our crimes, hell is simply the best punishment for sinners. I mean, that's all it is. It's the only just punishment for people who have turned against an eternally kind and faithful and loving God. And so the question is, how can God rescue us from death? Because He's in the same situation that Darius was in. How could He rescue Daniel from death? How could God, who loves us and wants us to be saved, save us from the law? How can He preserve us from hell and still be a just God? If He just lets us off the hook, that's not justice. if he just says, you know what, don't worry about it. Do whatever you want. That's if Obama today gave amnesty to a bunch of criminals, that wouldn't be justice. They're trying to do that right now, but that's not justice. And imagine if the president went even farther. He wrote a blanket pardon for every criminal in prison right now, including the rapists and the murderers and the child sex offenders. It would be a travesty of justice. So if God was to let people off the hook in the same way, it would be a travesty of justice. If God simply just forgives all the liars and the idol worshippers and the fornicators and the people who lust and gossip and blaspheme God's name and practice witchcraft and adultery and murderers and homosexuals and abortionists and everybody else who's sinned against God, if he just said, you know, I'm just going to let you go, I'm going to forgive you all, how can he do that and still be a just God? He can't. He has to maintain his good law. Every criminal who is punished reinforces God's justice. Every criminal who gets what they deserve because they've sinned against God and so they're cast into hell, they deserve that, and that reinforces God's law, and it keeps his kingdom safe, and it keeps his kingdom just. So why is it that people think they can ask God to just forgive him and be let off the hook for their sins? Just like that. How can we do that? We can't. It's impossible. There has to be something else to take care of the problem with the law. There has to be something done in order for our lives to be restored, in order for us to be given freedom. And we are given freedom. We know that. I think probably most Christians who go to church these days realize that that's what Christ offers us, is freedom, is restoration from being criminals and turned into righteous people. But the trick is what happened on the cross. The amazing thing, and we'll talk about atonement because we don't have time, we'll talk about that next week. But I want you to have a picture in your mind that God can't just let us go without doing something to take care of the law, without holding on to justice somehow. God can't just blanket pardon us and just let us go without hurting his kingdom, without hurting his law. And so Jesus dying on the cross is extremely important. And it's basically God dying in our place, taking what we deserve. And it's an amazing thing, and I'll explain more next week. But right now, let's share in a representation of that.